just show up and flood the place. So try and be there. It's 5 to 8 p.m. on Saturday, April the 26th. Thank you for listening. This is Alan Scarra, Crossroads in Rhythm. See you all at 12 noon next Thursday. The great spirit willing.
This is Bill McKibben from 350.org, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 on your FM dial, ACRA.
The Catskill Regional Invasive Species Partnership and Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties are sponsoring a Beetle Busters training on Monday, April 7th at 9:30 at ACRA, New York. The training covers the identification and survey techniques for forest pests in the Catskill region with a focus on emerald ash borer and Asian longhorn beetle. We welcome community members who are interested in spreading this knowledge and practices throughout the region. To register, contact Cornell Cooperative Extension at 518-622-9820. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Green Bee Greenhouse Limited in Cornwallville, New York, a non-certified organic nursery offering vegetable and herb seedlings, small fruits, perennials, shrubs, and trees. Located on 2744 Route 20 in Cornwallville, New York, at 518-429-9606, and online at greenbeegreenhouse.com. Open Thursdays through Sundays, 9 to 5. Green Bee Greenhouse, growing responsibly.
Hi there. I'm just getting here in the Hudson studio, getting situated. On a lovely spring day, we're so fortunate to finally see a bit of spring here in Hudson. Long winter, so we're all kind of waking up from a very cold and dismal winter, but spring is here. And this is the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler. And we are broadcasting locally on WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA, Catskill, Hudson, Greene, and Columbia Counties, New York, and streaming globally online at WGXC.org, and which is great because locally, if you're in Columbia, Greene County, and even points north near Albany and Berkshires, you can listen live on the radio, but there are listeners around the world, so welcome world, welcome our local listeners. And today I have in the Hudson studio, my guest is David McDonald. David is a self-taught filmmaker, and he's embarked upon a path of what I'd like to call visual storytelling. And among his projects that we'll be discussing, we have a full hour, is Woodstock Revisited, which is an awesome film, The Culture Wars, Chagall's American Exile, and a video series called The Mystery of Creativity. And David, thanks for that link. That was an awesome series. Actually watched it twice, so I hope we talk more about that series.
About the mystery of creativity?
Let me make sure I got your microphone. Talk up, Dave.
Talking about the mystery of creativity?
I don't hear you.
Let's try this one.
You're mic two.
Mic two.
Yeah. Mic two. Check.
Oh, that one's working.
All right. Is it mic two?
Try that one.
Here I am on mic two.
I don't know.
Does that work? Testing.
Something's working.
Okay, let's try
this one. Is that working?
Bingo! That's the one.
This is the one that's working?
I know. We have such a large studio here to find the microphones and the headphones.
I've just been playing croquet while waiting for you to get ready.
That's good. Did you win?
I did.
Make sure it's copying his.
So, welcome, David. This is actually the first time we've never talked on the phone.
We've never talked, but I think, Chad, you are one of the leaders in the social and cultural events in this town. So I'm very proud and pleased to meet you.
It was eventual that we would bump into each other, and I'm glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here.
So since this is the first time we've actually met and spoken to, let's go back in the early history of David. How far back can we go?
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn Heights, and eventually ended up working in the record business as a young adult in my 20s and 30s. And I was just telling you the origin of how I got started with Woodstock, which was in the 90s. I was a music publicist, international music publicist, initially for BMG in Berlin, and then for Elektra Entertainment in New York. I speak French and German.
Mm.
And around 1995, 96, 97, as a publicist for Elektra, I used to have a press list. And it was fascinating to me because I started out as a journalist, and I had some of the best music journalists from around the world on my press list. And we would have concerts in New York, like by AC/DC.
Great.
And I would go through my press list of so-and-so from England and so-and-so from Germany and so-and-so from Korea and invite them down to shows in the city. So at this point, there was a guy named Barney Hoskins, who incidentally is writing a book about Woodstock right now, who was living in Woodstock. He's an English journalist who writes for Mojo and Uncut, and he's written books about Laurel Canyon and Joni Mitchell. He specializes in rock music. Mm. And I didn't know him well, but we would have a show, and I'd email him from my press list, and I'd say, Barney, come on down. So Barney would come down to our offices on Rockefeller Center, and all of us at Elektra were completely delighted to meet him. And he would come down and tell us stories about Woodstock and Levon Helm and the band.
Yeah.
And this is where Levon crashed his car on Tinker Street. And something kind of got scratching in my head at that point. Like, I knew in the record business, no jobs lasted forever. It was a very dirty business. Mm. And that I mentally visualized, like, if I ever retire from this business, I'm moving to Woodstock. So in 1999, that's exactly what happened. Mm. And I got on a bus and got out at the Village Green, and I'm just like, I'm here, baby. And so got myself a place in town, and had been fascinated by all those stories. Like, where did Van Morrison live? Where did Bob Dylan live? Which one of the places did Bob Dylan live? I knew he lived on Bird Cliff, and I knew he lived on Ohio Mountain. So I would, like, drive around and check out these sites. And then at night I'd go out and sit in bars and talk to people. And somebody would be like, don't sit there. That's Rick Danko's chair. And I'd be like, well, Rick Danko died. Well, that was Rick's chair. To be a little serious, like, I started sniffing the vibe of the town, and it seemed like I had missed all the best days, and there had been a lot of loss in that town. And it's an interesting town because it's encircled by two mountains, and there are all sorts of myths about the Indians and it having been built on an Indian burial ground. Hmm. And it was not a place that human beings were supposed to live. And also, if you're a fan of music history, which I am, you know that some of the greatest records of that era came from that town. And, if you're a lover of Americana and the band, I mean, you have to be there. And you can smell it in the town. You drive by places and, early on in town, I got to know Elliot Landy, who to me was a hero, and I couldn't believe that I knew the guy, or I got to know him. And I'd be in House Hardware looking for plumbing supplies, and I'd be bumping into John Sebastian, and it would be hard not to go, I believe in magic. I do. And not to want to pick all these guys' brains. And I was living in Woodstock in 2001 when September 11th happened. And I hadn't even thought about becoming a filmmaker. Filmmaking was something that other people did, kids with money or kids who went to film school. Mm-hmm. But I had been a writer from the get-go. I mean, the writing is what got me into being in the music business, because I started writing press releases for them. So, and it was always a function of what I did, was writing. So I started dreaming. After September 11th, I kind of felt like, no conspiracy theory or anything like that, but I kind of felt like why this whole series of events had happened in our country that was more complicated than it was being led on for people to believe. And I wanted to kind of make a statement, and living, one of the statements being like, what happened to the counterculture in this country, where people, you know, we get what happened to us on September 11th was awful, no doubt about it, but it's a little bit more complicated. Our country's involvements in foreign debacles around the globe for years, nobody was talking about that. And living in Woodstock and seeing all this kind of death vibe around me and thinking about what had happened to the counterculture in America and where was it, what had happened to it, led me to start a process of thinking that eventually led to this movie that came out years later. Because I don't know, to me it was like a general malaise that had led to this. And so so in about 2002, I inherited some money and went out and got myself a Panasonic DVX-100 camera, which was the first camera of its kind, which was a film quality camera that a layman could afford, $3,500. And I got myself a big Tower Mac, and I taught myself Final Cut Pro, and I spent, you know, months reading books and manuals, and had gotten to become friends with Elliot Landy and wanted to do this film about Woodstock. So the first scenes that I ever did was like, I said to Elliot, hey, let's cruise around in the car and let's go to some of these spots where you took the photographs. And Elliot was extremely gracious to me after actually initially rejecting about 10 requests and telling me who the hell did I think I was.
Yeah.
I guess that's a funny story in and of itself because I filmed him, but he's still, you know, first-time filmmaker. Who the heck is this guy? Who does he think he is? And I was working in an editing bay behind Bread Alone in Woodstock, and I was putting together the Dylan section, and he walked in. He just happened to be going to get a coffee that day, and he walked into the editing bay and saw the piece, and he was like, oh, my God, you're really good. And I'm like, do you think I would be wasting my time if I didn't think I had a story to tell? So Elliot and I, you know, he had all these stories. Elliot had been a photographer for the Rat magazine, and Elliot's story in and of itself is interesting because he was just an underground magazine guy who got led in by Albert Grossman to all these insider venues back in the late 60s. He had no resume to show for. Mm. He had no background. He wasn't like one of the most famous rock photographers in the world. So he kind of transferred his breaks, in some senses, what had been done for him to me, and he gave me a chance. And so we started with the band, and then we ended up doing a section. We started with Dylan, and we ended up doing a section on the band. And I was surprised that not more journalists had asked Elliot for a sit down, you know, because his stories and his photography is amazing.
They're iconic.
Yeah, and I also had no idea what my visual look as a filmmaker would be. Like, I started editing the movie, and I found myself using lots of split screens, and that was for a variety of reasons. But one was, in a sense, a homage to the original Woodstock movie that, you know, had all those split screens and ongoing narratives going on, three narratives at a time.
Is that the Martin Scorsese?
Well, no, the Woodstock movie, Scorsese had been, I think, a camera person on it and edited part of it. But the Woodstock movie that 10 million people have seen and think that they went to the Woodstock Festival because they actually sat through that movie. And ironically enough, Elliot Landy's work is characterized by very hypersaturated images. You know, there's the famous solarized photograph of Bob Dylan in red leaning against a black Cadillac, famous picture. But Elliot had done more with color in the days before Photoshop than anyone. And I found myself as someone who didn't have any rules that I knew about. I hadn't been to film school. So, like, I love saturated imagery. Mm. And so I found myself using almost Disney-esque colors. And when I would film something, I would jack the colors up because it just fit with my aesthetic. The camera, when I started filming Woodstock Can't Get There From Here, which turned into Woodstock Revisited, ordinarily, like, I didn't know anything about the way to film people, but I knew that the mic on top of the camera could pick people's voices up better if I put the camera, like, if I was sitting in a cafe and I sat the camera up to their, like, pointed from the table up to their face, I knew I could get good audio. So if you look at the original film, there are a lot of nasal passages shots, which I later learned, you know, I got myself a boom mic and developed a better technique and a better way of miking people. But hopefully I'm not going on about this. Is this interesting? Should I keep talking about this?
Oh, I hope you do.
Okay. So what I wanted to do was, it dawned on me in Woodstock, what I looked at, and again, I'm coming from a place where I felt like the counterculture in America had died. And I think having been a real kind of hippie in much of my life and having had long hair, I really related to the 60s and who could not relate to Bob Dylan and the band and all that stuff, the Beatles. But as I lived in Woodstock, I was reminded on a daily basis how much of the incidents that had happened in Woodstock had actually led to the counterculture in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it's called Woodstock because, well, many people don't know. Do you know why? I mean, the festival is called Woodstock, but why it didn't happen in Woodstock?
It was, I'm guessing that it was meant to be in Woodstock originally, so that kind of moniker stayed, but the concert was not.
Yeah, well, the town fathers in Woodstock got wind of what Michael Lang was planning, and they said, "Are you crazy?" And Woodstock, here's another interesting paradox about the town of Woodstock. It was traditionally Republican, even though it had been known as an arts colony mm-hmm. since the dawn of the 20th century. Politically, it swung pretty much to the right all through those years. But a little primer on Woodstock history. In 1902, the first arts colony, one of the first in America, I think it was the second one technically, opened on the top of Overlook Mountain. It was called Bird Cliff. It was founded by a guy named Ralph Whitehead and his wife. And it was associated with the arts and crafts movement. And it was very much a back to the land kind of ethos. They were, it was a response to the industrial age. They decided to go up to the top of the mountain. They chose it because they thought they would build a vineyard there, which they never did. But according to the longitude and latitude, it was correct for making a vineyard. And they started a commune up there, which ended up going kind of going on and off through the century, but kind of didn't end up doing very well. And then there was a third member of that group named Hervey White, who was from the Dorothy Day group in St. Louis. He was a gay poet, philosopher, who started something called the Maverick, which was on Maverick Road in 1909. And Hervey, as I state in my film, and a lot of the people who knew him or talked about him said that he was really the first hippie. And if you see photographs from him from 1915, he looks like a total hippie. I mean, it's amazing. So he started the Maverick in 1909. They, like the Birdcliff, were traditionally out of money all the time. But artists from New York City, especially musicians, they had a relationship with the New York Philharmonic or one of those orchestras, would come up and they'd do their summers on Maverick Road with Hervey. And he was famous for, you know, if you asked Hervey for a shack, you know, he'd build you one for nothing and give it to you. And you could, like, there were outhouses. And But Edward G. Robinson lived there during the summers, and Helen Hayes. And there are a lot of people who had ties to the Maverick, Paul Robeson. So they'd come up to Woodstock, but that was, you know, that was as Maverick got established. But in the teens, one year they absolutely ran out of money, and they were trying to figure out a way to get their will fixed. And they stumbled upon this idea of having what they called Maverick festivals. And these festivals got established, I don't know exactly when, 13, 14, but long before the Woodstock Festival.
Yep.
And the first year, a few hundred people came. The second year, a few thousand people came. And within a few years, it was like Bacchanal on Maverick Road, where 5,000 or 10,000 people would come up to Woodstock, and they'd all get drunk and run around naked and drink from the creek and make babies in the woods. And the Maverick Festivals became very famous among the cognoscenti of that era. And they went on for 10 or 15 years. And then finally one year, it was around Prohibition time. There are two different stories about what happened. One was that the Ku Klux Klan got wind of these festivals, and they came in and stormed the festival one day. And then there's another tale that some right-wing itinerant preacher came and decided that they were, you know, the house of sin, and shut them down. So
that's a shame. But there seems to be a spirit that remained.
Yeah. And, you know, all along Maverick Road, famous artists were living. Raoul Haig. Who's that painter who was famous for doing the cartoon-like paintings? But they were many people were associated with Woodstock, and in the 40s, George Bellows lived there, and a lot of landscape painters ended up people as affiliated with the art school in New York that built an outpost in Woodstock. So this whole idea of Woodstock having been a haven for artists in the years prior to Bob Dylan was true, and Bob Dylan. Moving up to that era, a lot of people don't know that Peter, Paul, and Mary, well, a lot of things people don't know. Peter, Paul, and Mary were actually a prefabricated group. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
They were put together by Albert Grossman, who was Bob Dylan's manager, because he thought they were all three attractive people and wanted them to be together. So it was like the first super group, kiddie band in a way, except they were a folk group. And Peter Yarrow's family had a shack off of Broadview Road in Woodstock, which the remnants of the shack still exist to this day. And so Peter Yarrow was summering in Woodstock, and his manager, Albert Grossman, came up one summer, may have been 62 or 63, and Albert fell in love with the place and bought himself this huge acreage in Bearsville, thus becoming known as the Baron of Bearsville. And so he bought this huge house, and then he bought a recording studio, and then he bought everything that is now known as the Bear Cafe and On Veron's Utopia Recording Studios. He built for Todd Rundgren after he lost Bob Dylan as a client. He picked up Todd Rundgren as his major client. and so Bob, who was his client as well, started coming up to visit Albert in, I think, 63 or 64, before Bob was famous. And there was a cafe right in the middle of the town. Bob started spending a few weeks living above the cafe. And so there are these very famous photographs of him playing chess in outdoor seating in front of the cafe, and being visited by friends, including John Sebastian and Dick and Mimi Farina.
Wasn't Odetta?
Odetta.
Also.
All of those people. I got to take a breather to drink some tea because I have a cold.
Yeah. And that's in the snippet that is available online that people can see, that cafe and people reminiscing about the lore that these great people were playing. Great food, wasn't advertised. It was just a place to hang out. Or,
well, it wasn't a scene yet.
Yeah.
And then it became a scene, and Bob made the mistake of staying in Woodstock, first on in Birdcliff, Upper Birdcliff, near the old Birdcliff, and he had no security there.
Mm.
And if you drive up to where he used to live, you say to yourself, what was he thinking? Because it's a nice little estate there, but there are no walls. It's not walled in. So when he became a phenomenon, freaks from all over the world started going up to Woodstock. And so this whole Woodstock thing was like a movement long before. Like, everyone associates Woodstock with the festival.
Yes.
But it was really the festival, I argue, kind of put the lid on the whole thing. The festival brought it to, it made it, it commercialized the idea, but the ideas that had started Woodstock, actually, it didn't start in Woodstock, it started with Thoreau at Walden Pond.
Do you think that there, when you were speaking about the, let's say, the Republican aspect of, maybe conservative might be a better word, when they were starting to getting more and more artists who are traditionally more liberal coming up, did they feel invaded? And this was probably one of the reasons why the concert in 69 did not happen?
Yeah, well, okay. In 65 or 66, no one has the real memory of when it started. But now, since I made my Woodstock film, people have written books on the subject. There were these things called the sound outs. And they occurred on Glasgow Turnpike, and they were emceed by Bob Fass from WBAI. And Bob Fass came to visit me in Woodstock when I was making the film, and we looked through old, we were trying to find old videos or photographs of it, but everyone was tripping. but a lot of the same artists who would eventually end up, a lot of them moved to Woodstock prior to the years, prior to the festival. I mean, Hendrix was living in Shokan. Van Morrison was living up on O'Hale Mountain Road. Who else? The band were obviously living there. Bob Dylan was there. So all this stuff was going on in the years prior to the festival. Mm-hmm. And so the sound outs happen in 60, at least 67 and 68, and maybe 66. And people like Odetta and Richie Havens were all playing on top of a flatbed truck that they set up at a farm on Glasgow Turnpike, which has now been built up. It's like a little housing condominium complex there. It's across the street from the school. And the whole tradition of, like, crashing the gates and drinking from the stream and running around naked got started then. So, and I actually asked Michael Lang, the founder of the Woodstock Festival, on film in my camera, did you get your idea from the sound outs? Because nobody seems to know that. And he's like, yeah, that's what we were doing in those summers prior to the Woodstock Festival. Mm. So they would charge $1, and you'd show up, and you'd maybe paid or maybe didn't or maybe crashed the fence. But you asked about the right wing versus the left wing. Back during the sound outs eventually came to an end because the hippies got their asses kicked by a bunch of rednecks one year. and there were ongoing conflicts. Another person I interview in my film is Alan Van Wagenen, who was the town constable, who's a proud redneck and a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And he talks about how he would sit at the end of Tinker Street in his police car and look for VW microbuses and just salivate at the thought of, who am I going to bust today? But ironically enough, those old folks, the old Republicans or whatever in Woodstock, have been very supportive of me and my work over the years. And I'm an honorary member of the Woodstock American Legion, which is great because when I'm in town, I get to go sit there and have a beer. Alan Van Wagenen in particular was, those apocryphal stories about Levon Helm drinking too much and crashing his car in the middle of the Village Green. Alan was the guy who got him out of that predicament and proudly talks about it. And, you know, the band, it's like so many of these things are more complicated than they seem because, you know, Levon at least was a right-wing conservative during his later years, at least for a long time. And, you know, a good old boy from Arkansas, and he loved the Woodstock air. So what was interesting, actually, let me backtrack a little bit, because that, you know, Woodstock was founded by Dutch families, Alan Van Wagenen coming from that. And there was always that tradition in that town of tolerance among, and artists were perceived as good for the economy.
Because the Dutch were very much like that.
In some senses. But that whole, you know, Woodstock, you know, in the teens, 1910, was famous because a particular school of painting came about that involved painting people in the nude in fields. So tourists used to come from the city to, like, try to catch a glimpse of people painting nude models. Mm. So it had been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
So when Bob Dylan moved up there, there was this whole backstory that no one knew about why Dylan moved up there, which was to learn painting. And he also had just done his trip through England, and he was totally burned out on whatever drugs he had been doing. So he moved to Woodstock to raise a family, raise his kids, and to have a normal life again.
And when you were looking at making the film Woodstock Revisited, what did you want to portray? What's the story that you wanted to tell?
Well, again, remember, there are actually two different films. There's a film called Woodstock Can't Get There From Here, which, because of legal reasons, I can't show publicly. I haven't been able to show publicly in years. And then there's the second film, which was my adjusted version of Woodstock Can't Get There From Here, which is called Woodstock Revisited, which I can show and I can sell publicly, and I can. It's been in a whole lot of festivals around the world, and that always increases. The original version of the film, I wanted to do a metaphor for the rise and fall of the counterculture in America. That was Woodstock Can't Get There From Here. And I was particularly interested in drawing that line between Thoreau at Walden Pond, the Hudson River School of Painters, and then all those events that transpired in Woodstock. You know, the Hudson River School, as Peter Young will tell you, is, like, fascinating because a lot of those guys were involved in philosophy. And there was a philosopher, and I think named Swedenborg, who believed that God was in the land, that was the manifestation of God. And as someone who is an avid hiker for 10 years, I can, and this leads into the mystery of creativity, but I spent 10 years, 3 hours or 4 hours a day, walking the mountains of Woodstock all by myself or with my dog. Right. And how this story came to me, I have no idea. And how I was able to make that film, usually sitting down at a console like we are right now and writing it by hand and reading it onto a mic first draft, is mystifying to me. And all I know is that I had the story to tell that was post September 11th, which is, God, what happened here? Like, what happened to these values? And then I wanted to debunk the 60s a little bit because I feel like in high school, the head of my high school referred to me as a walking anachronism because I had long hair and I was totally hippied out.
Yeah.
But the hippie movement, in a way, like, killed all the movements after. There's never really been a sustained counterculture movement in the U.S., and I think it's because, you know, how can we compare with the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan circa 1965 or the Beatles? We can't. Like, and I think that's what kids for the last 30, 40 years have been thinking. Like, we can't compete with that, man. No way. So,
And the 60s, in a sense, in the entire 60s, I would say, from the civil rights movement to civil disorder, which was also part of the hippie movement, is iconic, at least in my mind. Like you say, the 60s have been difficult to repeat, and there has been the Occupy movement. But nothing has changed, not only the United States, but the world, than the 1960s in the United States.
Yeah. Paradoxically, and this is an aside, this has nothing to do with my work, but Pharrell Williams just came out with a song called Happy that has been adopted by groups around the world as a song of resistance and rebellion and freedom. Just the word happy. And I think if anyone is going to start a movement again, it's going to have to be without those paradigms from the 60s. So my goal, believe it or not, it sounds very modest, was to completely debunk the 60s or destroy them. And it was a different way than punk rock did it, because I wanted to really delve into what had happened and show people where it really happened. And if I had been living in San Francisco, I would have done a section about City Lights Bookstore or Marin County, where you're from.
Yeah.
But it just so happened, I was a documentary filmmaker. I didn't have any money to spend. And I was friends with Elliot Landy and John Sebastian. So I was like, okay, these guys are here. And they all have the stories, and they all tell me the stories. And I like to go sit and, you know, have a beer in a bar and listen to people tell stories. So I heard these stories. And some of them were dark, man.
Mm.
Like stories about the band and what kind of drugs they were mixed up in. And there was a lot that I had to not talk about.
I almost want to jump ahead a little bit, the Charlie Hewitt profile that you did. And he eloquently talks about the dark and the light and how it actually comes together for him in his creativity and spirituality and rebirth. And
okay, I'm going to backtrack a little bit because, like I said, I made that movie, and like the day Elliot Landy came by to look at my rough cuts that day, and I would look at that after finishing editing, and I would say to myself, who made that?
Mm.
That's not me. I mean, I had no idea that I was capable of that. And I was 42. Like, I had just had a normal life until then. I mean, I always thought that I had something great inside me, and I would listen to The Only Living Boy in New York by Simon and Garfunkel and think, oh, that's me. I've got something. But I think everyone feels that way. And I didn't think that I had anything special to offer. And so when I made that film, and it was repeated, like every section of that film I did, I would emerge from the editing room and go, what the? Where did that come from? And
do you think you were channeling something?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I know for me that it involved literally 3 hours a day of walking up Mink Hollow, you know, that, or around Cooper Lake or wherever I was, but not interacting with my fellow human beings, getting away, being by myself. And that's an interesting subtext of my Woodstock film, which nobody knows or nobody's ever talked about, which is the whole dynamic between group movements and the idea that in order to discover consciousness, you actually have to be by yourself. But anyway, I made this movie. I would sit, you know, with hundreds of people at a festival. They'd ask me questions about it, and I'd be like, I don't know. And one of the guys who contributed music to the film is a guy named Patrick Watson, who's become a big star. I was living in Montreal during some of the making of this film, long story, but Patrick Watson was a friend of mine from Montreal. And Patrick's got this goofy kind of, you know, kid-like thing, like, where do people come up with this stuff? And they don't even know. So I've had this experience over and over, like, I don't know where I came up with that, but I know that I had potential within myself, clearly, that I hadn't even dreamed about. So, and very much in touch with the dark side. It's the light and the dark. It's the extremes of the two. And in order to go to that place where you're channeling, you have to go bury a hole deep up your own butt. And it's not a really healthy place to go. But I'm not doing a very good job of explaining this. So after, and then I made Woodstock Can't Get There From Here, and I got into legal issues, and I realized, oh, my God, my work can really hurt people if I'm naming names and talking about this or that. And then I made Woodstock Revisited. I recut it. I spent 2 years recutting it up in Montreal. Then I came back to Woodstock. I was in a relationship. My wife and I broke up, so I ended up moving back to Woodstock. And I realized that the power of film to transformative power, like the power of any art, but my own capabilities as a human being and as a filmmaker to do transformational stuff. So I then decided, because of this mystifying, still to this day, I look at sections of the film and I'm like, I did that 10 years ago and I have no idea how I did it or where it came from. It's channeling. Mm-hmm. What am I channeling? I don't even believe in God, so how could I be channeling God? You know, what am I channeling? And what part of this creative process is the result of inspiration, my own genius, or just my own neurosis, like being obsessive compulsive? Oh, I found the perfect job. I can sit and edit a piece of movie, a movie clip, for 20 hours. Anyone else would be sick after 5 minutes, and I can hone it and hone it and hone it so that the music is completely in sync with the vocal, which is completely in sync with the images. Like, what part of that comes from me? What part of it comes from God? What part of it comes from my own craziness? Do I have to go in and really investigate my own craziness? Am I going to be a madman making movies for the rest of my life? So long and the short of it is I started filming other artists as a kind of therapeutic thing for myself.
Although, I if you wanted to talk about it, your short film about living on wit's end, seems to be,
you saw that.
I love that, and it's sort of autobiography. It's storytelling.
I was totally, I mean, if I was allowed to, like, people always ask me what kind of documentaries I love, and I'm like, I don't like documentaries. I really don't like documentaries. So Woodstock, all my Woodstock work could be classified as a documentary, but it's really like a sound collage montage, right? It's, I mean, yeah, there's me stating the facts. Bob Dylan moved to Woodstock, and but it's all a mashup of music and that's. But I'm trying to stay on point here. So, but I really, with the culture wars, and then with crazy ass white boy, I really decided to start playing around with the genre and adding fantasy elements. And because I did the short film after I made Woodstock Can't Get There From Here and was forced to cut the last 40 minutes of it, which is the part that had the really socioeconomic commentary about what had happened to the 60s, I recut that, moved back to Montreal, recut it, came out with Woodstock Revisited, which has additional scenes on the band and Bob Chandler in Rhinebeck, and a different beginning and a different ending, visit to the artist cemetery in Woodstock. But in order to, because I still had a political statement I wanted to make. Oh, my God.
I know, time flies.
I made this short film called The Culture Wars. But, and in that film, I started incorporating elements of drama into, because the whole documentary is kind of a cheesy form in my book. And I think some people are starting to make really wild documentaries. Like I saw one the other day, you know, it's a genre because everyone expects the deliverer of the documentary to be completely objective, but who's objective?
Yeah.
Who literally is objective? But anyway, back to the mystery of creativity, because that's the most interesting subject, and that's what a lot of my work has to do with these days. I think every human being has capabilities that they have no idea about. And I don't know what happened to me. Maybe it was my ability to spend a lot of time alone in my early 40s hiking or having the peace of mind to be able to do it. But for me, walking is the equivalent of meditation, and a lot of Buddhists do walking meditation. So I would you know, do a 5-mile hike up the mountain in Woodstock. And I don't know whether these ghosts of Woodstock were coming to me or it was just my own natural curiosity to find out about Birdcliff and the Maverick or whatever. But they came to me because I was an open channel. And I think every human being, if they give themselves the opportunity, has that capability. In order to do it, you have to like yourself enough to be able to sit down, and you have to quiet all those running demons in your own head that tell you you're not good enough to do this or you're not good enough to do this. One of the things about the series about creativity that I started, and I started with Charlie Hewitt, you don't have to be a painter. You can be an auto mechanic. There are people in life who are doing extraordinary things, whether it's the way they cook or it's the way they treat their other human beings, that are channeling, so to speak. And so it was my experience, having made a lot of people angry at me with my work, which was unintentionally critical, that I thought, okay, well, I'm gonna do work that leads human consciousness forward, because I've been blessed with this ability. Like, who gets this chance to really feel like they're channeling? Like, not many of us. Like, I've been blessed with this gift, so I'm going to try to spread it to other people.
That's why, you know, one of the visuals that you had with Charlie Hewitt when he was holding the hammer, and in a sense of, you know, this was my tool to earn a living, and almost in a sense, you know, holding metaphorically the paintbrush or, you know, the sculpting tool and saying this supported the other. And he's not ashamed of either.
Yeah. And there, I mean, literally this whole idea that someone's doing something that's more noble than anyone else is absurd. Like, so what I've kind of started to do with Mystery of Creativity, but also in my professional work whenever possible, like, last year, I did a series of ads for House Hardware, TV ads, one of which was talking about a friend of mine named Randy, who works for the Volunteer Fire Department in Woodstock, and it shows how the store supports him in doing his work and how his work supports the community. I did a video for Chronogram on the O Positive Festival in Kingston, which is a weekend where doctors and musicians exchange services. So whenever possible in my work, I'm trying to explore, it's not goody-goody stuff in any respect, but it's trying to explore, we as human beings, it's very easy for us to be, here's a metaphor, we're all in a well, and we're all trying to climb our way out of the well. And it's very much easier for all of us to try to grab the other guy's shoulders to move ourselves out of the well and put the other person down. And there are a few people I know, or many people I know, who get past that ego point in their lives. And then they discover that, oh, my God, it's really good for me if I help my other guy, my other member of my community. And so whenever possible in my work, I try to show people who are doing that. And, you know, it could be the guy who's painting, or it could be the guy who's working on cars, or, you know, there are people who bring love and joy into their lives and spread it, and they make the determination, and it's people from all walks of life.
Well, how would you like to do this series? How many besides Charlie Hewitt?
Well, I've done about an hour in content. As you may have guessed, just from talking to me, I'm not really good at selling my work, so I just and that's here's another thing I'll bring up. So what interested me in what I've been working on 2 years ago, I stumbled upon this story in High Falls, New York. And it was about how the artist Marc Chagall had moved to High Falls in the late 1940s, had a child out of wedlock with this much younger woman, and he lived at the end of Mohonk Mountain Road in High Falls between like 1946 and 1948, and became absolutely absorbed in that story. Because Marc Chagall had a lot of traits which are similar to mine, one of which is fiddling while rum burns. And Chagall, in the First World War, had been living in Paris. How much more time you got?
We have about 10 more minutes. And just remind our listeners, we're talking to David McDonald. here on WGXC 9.7. Go, David, go.
Okay, well, Chad, let me just say that I'd like to do this regularly with you. But anyway, Marc Chagall, famous artist. Nobody knows about him. Nobody really knows much about him. And so there was this exhibit in High Falls documenting photographs of him having lived in High Falls. No one knew who he was when he lived there because he didn't socialize with his neighbors. He wasn't super famous at that point. They called him the chicken painter because they, like, the rednecks saw him that he painted chickens on the barn. They're like, oh, it's the chicken painter. But Marc Chagall's story was very interesting to me. Again, it's a metaphor. Like, everything I've ever done is a metaphor. And Chagall, I saw his story. He had lived in Paris before the First World War. He became a refugee. He lived in a building called La Ruche with Modigliani and Diego Rivera. He was forced to leave France. He lost all of his work in France in this building called La Ruche. His roommate was Apollinaire the poet. Apollinaire had stolen all of his... Apollinaire and a French poet named Blaise Cendrat had... Chagall had been forced to leave all his paintings behind when the First World War broke out because he had to go back to Belarus. His two best friends took all his paintings and sold them to the highest bidder. Chagall had a show in Berlin before he went back to Belarus as well. A guy named Herwarth Walden, who was the founder of a gallery called Der Sturm, had given him his lucky break. He also stole all of Chagall's work. So Chagall had his work repeatedly stolen, repeatedly failed to deal with it. and the story of Chagall... just struck me as such a great metaphor for the story of the artists themselves. Because most artists, like for me as an artist, I have one hat that I put on, and then it's really hard to tell. Even though, ironically enough, I was a publicist in the record business, it's really hard for me to go from that really dark, concentrated place to like, oh, I'm going to a film festival now. I'm going to go to a meeting in New York and pitch this.
And before we go any further, I'm sure a lot of people would like to know, where can I see all these fabulous films, clips, and bits of information? Where can we see that online?
Well, I've got a lot of my stuff on Vimeo, and you'd have to read the URLs. Or friend me on Facebook, David McDonald, David the Director on Facebook. The Woodstock movie, you can buy a hard copy of the DVD at woodstockrevisited.webs.com. I am going to be moving over to Vimeo and putting Woodstock Revisited on pay-per-view within the next month or so. So
great.
If you want to spend a buck to watch the movie, you can do that. That seems like a much smarter way of doing it.
That's a good idea.
And being that we don't have a lot... more time, and I don't think I've really terribly put my foot in my mouth yet. Let's talk about the Hudson Music Festival, because you are doing the kind of thing that I'm really into. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, the Hudson Music Festival, it's maybe a little bit like Woodstock, except dialed back, which was... Hudson is a community where there are a lot of artists, a lot of musicians, and it's been building over numerous years. And even before I arrived in the Hudson area in 06, that movement had begun already.
And your background, you grew up in California?
From the San Francisco Bay Area. So, you know, the Haight-Ashbury, you know, the Grateful Dead, you know, growing up in the 60s. I did light shows at a local place where we did local music. And so that's where, you know, my musical background began. And I like producing, I like creating. So when we thought about doing this music festival, and believe me, you know, I was not the only one. Rob Johansson and I basically got started talking to all the musicians locally. The music venues like Basilica and Helsinki and Spotty Dog and saying, let's do a music festival. So that's kind of how it got started, and putting music on the street, making it free. That's something that we've always done and will continue to do, because we feel that for this kind of festival is to present music free. And we started with local bands, and now we're getting submissions from South America, South Africa, from coast to coast, Canada, and it's grown, and we hope to continue, get more people to Hudson, more people to enjoy this wonderful art form of music and sound.
And how are things looking now? Like, what's the status of things legally, and how's the town supporting or not supporting?
I think overall the Hudson and Columbia County is very supportive, and I think musicians are also. You can't please all the people all the time, but if you have a dream, that's the dream that goes forward. So right now we've had, we haven't done any press releases yet, nor do we have a dollar in our piggy bank, but, this is the start of fundraising. But we already have close to 175 acts that have signed up, and we have to, and that'll probably grow to eventually 300, and we have to curate that down to about 100. So we've got 4 months to do it, which is not that unreasonable, but it's a lot of work, and willing to do it.
Now, here we are on the town square in Hudson, and we're our audio viewers won't necessarily know this, but we're pretty much next door to the building that Marina Abramovich has bought, the foundation has bought, to make the Abramovich Foundation. What's your take on that?
I love it. I love TSL, the Hudson Opera House, Basilica, and the local cultural arts organizations that are here to thrive and show different kinds of work. I'm myself working at trying to get some installation art on the streets of Hudson, because there's very little, and I think with a community of artists, I think there should be more art out there for people to experience. I think we have, as someone has told me once before, Hudson has more art galleries per capita than New York City, which, of course, New York City is millions of people, but between antique stores, home goods, art galleries, you can walk up and down Warren Street and be inspired by so much, and I love that about Hudson, and it's one of the reasons why I moved from New York City here.
How are we doing on time?
Well,
one more question.
Oh yeah, we've got let's say 2 minutes. I can check the actual time. Mr. Clock on the wall is not always accurate, but
okay. Here's my last question that I'm going to pose to you, because it's my next film, Chad.
Excellent. Talk about it.
You know, Hudson's been hyped a lot. Hudson's been talked about in articles by David Byrne. The New York Times, Daily News talks about Hudson. And lots of residents in town, lots of the young artists who've moved here are concerned that Hudson's going to get ruined by the new gentrifying class. Is that going to happen?
Good question. I wouldn't even want to know how to qualify that, because I lived in Hoboken for 4 years.
Me too.
In the early 80s, and there was certainly a gentrification that was going on at that time, which in some ways was very sad to see a lot of original families being displaced, but there was a new energy that was happening at the same time. So I don't know. Gentrification, you could have a whole workshop or a discussion about, the goods and the bads of it.
Well, let's sit here and talk with Marina about gentrification next week on Chad's show.
That's a good idea. Marina has been on WGXC, and I know she will continue to be. She's a friend of WGXC, and so let's make sure that happens, David.
Well, Chad, that was very nice of you to have me on.
Oh, pleasure. I think you're right. We'll do a part two at some point because there's a lot that we can talk about.
Excellent.
So I'm now looking at the official time. You've been listening to The Art of the Hudson Valley.
This is Joel Chatterson saying sign off. John Lennon here.
David McDonald, thank you for being a guest here in the Hudson studio on WGXE, The Art of the Hudson Valley. And I will return 1 month later.